everything works out with it. VOA won the hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Dan Novak and Mario Ritter Jr. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Dan Novak.
The official number of worldwide deaths from COVID-19 passed 6 million on Monday. The number shows how the pandemic, now in its third year, is far from over. The Coronavirus Research Center at Johns Hopkins University in Maryland recorded the total. The virus continues to kill large numbers of people, even as people stop wearing face coverings and begin to travel more freely. Small Pacific islands are experiencing their first large spread of the virus. The isolation of such nations had protected them for more than 2 years. Hong Kong is also seeing deaths quickly rise. It is testing its entire population of 7.5 million three times this month. Death rates remain high in Poland, Hungary, Romania, and other Eastern European countries. The area has also seen more than 1.5 million refugees recently arrive from Ukraine. Ukraine has had poor vaccination rates and high rates of cases and deaths. The United States has recorded nearly 1 million deaths, even with the country's high vaccine availability and wealth. The U.S. has the highest official death toll in the world. Case numbers in the U.S. have been dropping over the last month. Death rates worldwide are still highest among people who are not vaccinated against the virus, said Tiki Pang. He is a professor at the National University of Singapore's Medical School and former researcher with the World Health Organization. The large majority of the deaths and the severe cases are in the unvaccinated, vulnerable segment of the population, Pang said. It took the world 7 months to record its first million deaths from the virus after the pandemic began in early 2020. 4 months later, another million people had died, and 1 million have died every 3 months since. The death toll hit 5 million at the end of October. Now it has reached 6 million. The world very likely hit its 6 millionth death some time ago. Poor record-keeping and testing in many parts of the world has led to an undercount in coronavirus deaths. There has also been an undercount in excess deaths. Those are deaths related to the pandemic, but not from actual COVID-19 infection. They include people who died from preventable causes, but could not receive treatment because hospitals were full. Research on excess deaths by a team at The Economist estimates that the number of deaths from the pandemic is between 14.1 million and 23.8 million. The world has seen more than 445 million confirmed COVID-19 cases. New weekly cases have been declining quickly in all areas of the world except for the Western Pacific, the World Health Organization reported this week. That includes China, Japan, and South Korea. The worldwide vaccine gap continues. just 6.95% of people in poor countries are fully vaccinated. But more than 73% have been vaccinated in wealthy nations, says research organization Our World in Data. However, at the end of last month, Africa passed Europe in the number of vaccine shots given daily. Still, only 12.5% of the continent's population has received two shots. With about 250,000 reported deaths, Africa's lower death rate is thought to be from underreporting. There is also a younger and less mobile population there. Africa is a big question mark for me, because it has been relatively spared from the worst so far, but it could just be a time bomb, Pong said. He noted the continent's low vaccination rates. I'm Dan Novak.
Negotiations on new rules for dealing with pandemics have begun at the World Health Organization. The United Nations Health Agency has set a target date of May 2024 for its 194 member countries to reach an agreement. The goal is to develop rules for dealing with infectious diseases that affect the world. A new agreement is among more than 200 recommendations for improving defenses against new infectious materials. The recommendations were made in studies of the COVID-19 pandemic that has caused the deaths of more than 6.2 million people in 2 years. An independent advisory group described the WHO as underpowered when COVID-19 appeared. It said the agency had limited powers to investigate outbreaks and to organize measures to limit the spread of disease. On February 17th, U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen called on the G20 economic powers to create a fund at the World Bank to help prevent global pandemics. It is among the efforts that could decide the future of the 74-year-old body. The WHO already has rules, known as the International Health Regulations, which were last updated in 2005. The rules set out countries' responsibilities when public health events can cross borders. The rules have the force of international law. These include advising the WHO immediately of health emergencies and of measures related to trade and travel. The updates of the current version were developed after the 2002 to 2003 SARS virus outbreak. These regulations are still considered operational for regional epidemics like the Ebola virus, but not enough for a global pandemic like COVID-19. Suggested proposals for a new agreement include the sharing of information and genome sequences of viruses. Other proposals include rules for providing vaccines fairly. A European Union official told Reuters the EU is pushing for a ban on wildlife markets. It also wants incentives for reporting of new viruses or variants. Member states have until August to decide on an early version of the agreement which WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus supports. He is likely to be elected unopposed for a second term in May. A new set of rules would be only the second major health agreement since the 2003 Framework Convention on Tobacco Control. It is a legally binding treaty which aims to reduce smoking through taxation and rules on labeling and advertising. The EU proposed a new treaty and is its biggest backer, with support from Britain, Indonesia, Kenya, and some other countries. The United States will take part in the talks, but has opposed a treaty with the force of international law. India and Brazil have also voiced concerns. With more than 190 member countries involved, securing a new agreement will be difficult. The legal nature of any new agreement remains to be defined by talks. The WHO uses special words to describe such agreements. The WHO generally calls it an instrument. The agency has three kinds of instruments: recommendations, regulations, and conventions. Of those, regulations are automatically legally binding or possess the force of international law for members unless they object. It is not yet clear how the 2005 regulations and a new pandemic treaty might fit together. One suggestion is that they should work together. In this proposal, existing rules would be used for local outbreaks. The new treaty would take effect if the WHO declares a pandemic. It remains to be decided whether negotiators will include enforcement measures such as sanctions. Separate talks on a U.S. proposal to update the 2005 rules have been taking place. U.S. proposals aim to increase openness and permit the WHO to faster reach places where outbreaks are happening. Several diplomats said the proposals are likely to be opposed. They say China and other nations are expected to reject such measures on national sovereignty grounds. China did permit WHO-led expert teams to visit Wuhan, where the COVID-19 pandemic started. But the WHO says it is still withholding clinical data from early cases that may hold clues about how the SARS COVID-2 virus started. Another working group of WHO member countries is discussing reforms to the WHO funding structure. They want money to be available in the event of a pandemic. So far, the United States, which is the WHO's top donor, has opposed plans to increase member countries' yearly payments. I'm Mario Ritter, Jr.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. History is usually a process of slow change. However, certain events also can change the course of history. Napoleon's defeat at Waterloo was such an event. So was the first airplane flight by the Wright brothers, or the meeting between the Spanish explorer Cortes and the Aztec king Montezuma. All these events were moments that changed history. And so it was, too, with the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special news bulletin. The Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, by air, President Roosevelt has just announced. The attack also was made on all naval and military activities on the principal island of Oahu.
We take you now to Washington.
The details are not available. They will be in a few minutes. The White House is now giving out a statement. The attack apparently was made on all naval and military activities on the principal island of Oahu. The president's brief statement was read to reporters by Stephen Early, the president's secretary. A Japanese attack upon Pearl Harbor naturally would mean war. Such an attack would naturally bring a counterattack, and hostilities of this kind would naturally mean that the president would ask Congress for a declaration of war.
The surprise attack on America's large naval base in Hawaii was a great military success for Japan. However, the attack on Pearl Harbor had more than a military meaning. The attack would force Americans to enter World War II. More importantly, it would also make them better recognize their position as one of the most powerful nations in the world. In future weeks, we will discuss the military and political events of World War II. But today we look back at the years before the United States entered that war. The period between the end of World War I and the attack on Pearl Harbor lasted only 23 years, from 1918 to 1941. But those years were filled with important changes in American politics, culture, and traditions. We start our review of these years with politics. In 1920, Americans elected Republican Warren Harding to the presidency. The voters were tired of the progressive policies of Democratic President Woodrow Wilson. They were especially tired of Wilson's desire for the United States to play an active role in the new League of Nations. Harding was a conservative Republican, and so were the two presidents who followed him, Calvin Coolidge and Herbert Hoover. All three of these presidents generally followed conservative economic policies, and they did not take an active part in world affairs. Americans turned away from Republican rule in the election of 1932. They elected the Democratic presidential candidate, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and they continued to re-elect him. In this way, the conservative Republican policies of the 1920s changed to the more progressive policies of Roosevelt in the 1930s. The change happened mainly because of economic troubles.
So keep cool and keep Coolidge is the slogan of today.
The 1920s were a time of growth and business strength. President Calvin Coolidge said during his term that the chief business of the American people is business. This generally was the same belief of the other Republican presidents during the period, Warren Harding and Herbert Hoover. There was a good reason for this. The economy expanded greatly during the 1920s. Many Americans made a great deal of money on the stock market, and wages for workers increased as well. However, economic growth ended suddenly with the stock market crash of October 1929. In that month, the stocks for many leading companies fell sharply, and they continued to fall in the months that followed. Many Americans lost great amounts of money, and the public at large lost faith in the economy. Soon, the economy was in ruins, and businesses were closing their doors. President Hoover tried to solve the crisis, but he was not willing to take the strong actions that were needed to end it. As time passed, many Americans began to blame Hoover for the terrible economic depression. Democrat Franklin Roosevelt was elected mainly because he promised to try new solutions to end the Great Depression.
This great nation will endure as it has endured, will revive and will prosper. So first of all, let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror, which paralyzes needed efforts to convert retreat into advance.
Soon after he was elected, Roosevelt launched a number of imaginative economic policies to solve the crisis.
Our greatest primary task is to put people to work. This is no unsolvable problem if we face it wisely and courageously. It can be accomplished in part by direct recruiting by the government itself, treating the task as we would treat the emergency of a war, but at the same time, through this employment, accomplishing greatly needed projects to stimulate and reorganize the use of our great natural resources. Hand in hand with that, we must frankly recognize the overbalance of population in our industrial centers, and by engaging on a national scale in a redistribution, endeavor to provide a better use of the land for those best fitted for the land. Yes, the task can be helped by definite efforts to raise the values of agricultural products, and with this the power to purchase the output of our cities. It can be helped by preventing realistically the tragedy of the growing loss through foreclosure of our small homes and our farms. It can be helped by insistence that the federal, the state, and the local governments act forthwith on the demand that their cost be drastically reduced.
Roosevelt's policies helped to reduce the amount of human suffering. But the Great Depression finally ended only with America's entry into World War II. Roosevelt's victory in 1932 also helped change the balance of power in American politics. Roosevelt brought new kinds of Americans to positions of power: labor union leaders, Roman Catholics, Jews, blacks, Americans from families that had come from places such as Italy, Ireland, and Russia. These Americans repaid Roosevelt by giving the Democratic Party their votes. The 1920s and 30s also brought basic changes in how Americans dealt with many of their social and economic problems. The 1920s generally were a period of economic growth with little government intervention in the day-to-day lives of the people. But the terrible conditions of the Great Depression during the 1930s forced Roosevelt and the federal government to experiment with new policies. The government began to take an active role in offering relief to the poor. It started programs to give food and money to poor people, and it created jobs for workers. The government grew in other ways. It created major programs for farmers. It set regulations for the stock market. It built dams, roads, and airports. American government looked much different at the end of this period between the World Wars than it did at the beginning. Government had become larger and more important. It dealt with many more issues in people's lives than it ever had before. Social protest increased during the 1920s and 30s. Some black Americans began to speak out more actively about unfair laws and customs. Blacks in great numbers moved from the southern part of the country to northern and central cities. The 1920s and 30s also were a time of change for women. Women began to wear less conservative kinds of clothes. Washing machines and other inventions allowed them to spend less time doing housework. Women could smoke or drink in public, at least in large cities, and many women held jobs. Of course, the women's movement was not new. Long years of work by such women's leaders as Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony had helped women win the constitutional right to vote in 1920. The 1920s and 30s also were important periods in the arts. George Gershwin wrote his Rhapsody in Blue, originally for piano and jazz band. It later went on to become a symphony concert favorite. Writers like Ernest Hemingway, William Faulkner, Eugene O'Neill, and others made this what many called the golden age of American writing. Frank Lloyd Wright and other architects designed great buildings for American cities. Film actors like Clark Gable and radio entertainers like Jack Benny did more than make Americans laugh or cry. They also helped unite the country. Millions of Americans could watch or listen to the same show at the same time. Politics, the economy, social traditions, art, all these changed for Americans during the 1920s and 30s. And many of these changes also had effects in countries beyond America's borders. However, the change that had the most meaning for the rest of the world was the change produced by the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. America's modern history as a great superpower begins with its reaction to that attack. It was a sudden event in the flow of history. It was a day on which a young land suddenly became fully grown.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.